February 15th Rules Committee. I hope everyone had a delightful Valentine's Day. And I'm going to open a public hearing on SJR 5 and request that Senator Schroeder come before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate your giving me the courtesy of launching into this as the day gets busy pretty fast for all of us. SJR 5, very simple bill. As you can see before you, merely a few sentences. Legislature of the people may enact laws to limit or prohibit contributions or expenditures in campaigns for public office. This is an outgrowth. This particular bill, I think, is an outgrowth of some interest that I've had for a long time in campaign finance. My second election, I campaigned under the 1994 initiative, was successful. So you can get elected to office under this sort of rubric. I think this sort of thing is long overdue for Oregon. As many of you know, the aggregate costs of U.S. House and Senate races over the last two decades have jumped from $100 million to over $1 billion. I mean, there's something wrong here. We're spending this much money on campaigns and so little on public services and education. Also point out that we're one of only, I think, five states now that have absolutely unlimited campaign contributions. I don't think that speaks well to Oregon or Oregon's traditional history of open public process. This type of legislation is critical given the nature of Oregon's constitution and how the free speech clause has been interpreted. We need to lessen the influence of money in politics, pretty straightforward, get past the point where money equals free speech in totality. Previous campaign contribution expenditure limits law or initiative was struck down in the Venata-Kiesling case in 97. There's absolutely no protections for us or Oregonians at this point in time. I've introduced statutory legislation and other SJRs in the past. I think at this point, until we get the opportunity to put this before the people of the state of Oregon and see if they are interested in some sort of modest and thoughtful limits on contributions and expenditures, somewhat akin to what we now have in the U.S. as a result of the Nixon Shrink Missouri case, that we're going to be open for more and more expensive campaigns where the bigger and more moneyed special interests are able to far outweigh the interests of the average citizen. So with that, I won't belabor the bill. I think it's an excellent bill, good starting point for the conversation. I would hope that this committee would entertain passing it out and getting the discussion before the people of the state of Oregon, what sort of state they want to have and how do they want it run.
Thank you. Senator Schroeder, your proposal includes both contribution and expenditures. Could you talk about why you included expenditures and why you don't see that as a true infringement upon candidates' free speech?
Sure. That's a fair comment. And this is going to be an interesting discussion, I think, the committee will have, because you'll have a special interest weighing in, ACLU weighing in, lots of different groups. I think that I would go to the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions, and I think there's the opportunity to not only limit contributions, to limit the appearance of corruption. I think the expenditure aspect should also play under that a little bit. I believe that there's an opportunity here for us to get both the expenditure and contribution limits in line, which is something that I think Oregonians would be expecting at this point in time. I'm also open that there are potential problems with this bill, as you're probably well aware. Under the Armada law or interpretation, we'd have to look very closely at the best way to craft this. And I would yield to some of the committee's wisdom if there's a better way to put this together that would at least get it out before the people and make it something that the courts of this great state would find acceptable.
Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Good morning. I'm losing my voice, though.
It'll make for a much more pleasant day for all of us then, Senator Ringo, won't it?
It's not going to stop me from talking. It'll just make it more irritating.
Good morning again.
Madam Chair, I had SJR 3 drafted, And as you pointed out, three relates to contributions and not expenditures. I think we need to consider the Armada question, but if we're satisfied that that's not a hurdle, I think we ought to go with SJR-5 because it's more expansive. And it doesn't take away any rights that were not guaranteed by the federal constitution. And I think this committee needs to ask, what is it about the Oregon Constitution with respect to money and free speech that we feel we have to have in Oregon, and in other parts of the country, they're just, boy, they're languishing in some sort of despair because they can't spend money on campaigns quite like we can. And I've never heard anything convincing. So I think that we ought to be as aggressive as we can in terms of at least bringing us in line with the other states in the country. And what they have done, I mean, there's a whole range of contribution limits or expenditure proposals, expenditure limits that have found to be acceptable. And I don't think anybody has said, oh, this is damaging our democracy or damaging free speech. So I'm very grateful that Senator Schrader's brought SJR-5. If he thinks it's better to go with SJR-3, I'm fine with that too. But I think he's exactly right. I mean, money in politics is a very corrosive influence, and we've got to do everything we can to at least set the stage by passing constitutional amendments so that down the road, then we can address what specific limitations we think are appropriate.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Schrader, any specific examples where the influence of money has changed legislators' votes?
legislators'
votes.
Well, I would be hard-pressed to state any particular definitive instances because I would like to retain my position in the state legislature.
Madam Chairman, I couldn't take the 50 dollars.
But I would, it's a good question, Madam Chair, and I guess in the Nixon Missouri shrink, it was the appearance of corruption. So it's not so much, I think my colleagues I know to be honorable, well, except for maybe one, and that it's I think it's the appearance of corruption that people are concerned about. And while we all know, I think, that while we accept campaign contributions from a wide variety of people, and they don't necessarily influence our vote on any one thing, we do have moral fiber, we do have certain philosophies, certain political orientations that guide us in our votes, as well as we're trying to represent the people that elect us. But that appearance can be a corrosive influence, as Senator Ringo alluded to, and that's the thing we need to protect from. That's what gets people so disenchanted, so disenfranchised with the system when they see that appearance. Some things, I will point out a few simple things. I was offered, as co-chair of Ways and Means last session, I was offered a role in one of the film and video industry's movies that was coming to Oregon, you know, some sort of bit part. I think most of the leadership was invited to participate in that. And you know, my initial reaction was very different than a lot of others. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, I guess that's done often. It has been done, and it's been done in other states. But if I'm John Q. Citizen, and I see Kurt Schrader getting in some movie just because he's co-chair of Ways and Means, and the film industry's budget is coming before the co-chair of Ways and Means, what does that say to Oregonians? What
so
message does that
movie
give them? Bad movie, bad politics. And so I think we need to get past that sort of thing where people can't infringe on Oregonian sense of right and fairness, which theoretically up until the last few years has been a hallmark of what this great state stands for.
So you're saying, Senator Schrader, that there is no corruption or minimal corruption. There is the appearance of corruption by nature, by the virtue of the fact that we take money in order to run for office.
We take a lot, by virtue of fact, yes, Madam Chair, we take a lot of money to run for office. Thank you for stating
that. Thank you. Senator Shields.
Senator Schrader, I look at this issue like a lot of issues in the state of Oregon. At one time, Oregon could brag about how good its K-12 education was, and we spent good amounts of money on getting the job done, and we had an Oregon health plan that was a pattern for the nation, and, you know, we had assessed ourselves a ballot measure to get there. And yet we seem to be sitting still, and others have moved on ahead of us in a lot of ways, in a lot of categories, whether it's education or health care or whatever. My question is, has that happened likewise in campaign finance reform? Have others taken off and left us in the dust? For instance, 10 years ago, if you had an appointment with Kate Brown and she was in California chairing a committee, somebody might make a breakfast appointment to see her, but if a certain campaign contribution didn't arrive before that breakfast, the breakfast got canceled. Okay? That's the way it was. I don't know what it's like out there now. Have you seen things like that go away in other states? I mean, we've prided ourselves as being cleaner than a lot of states, and yet maybe they've cleaned up their act while we're sitting here kind of in neutral in the last 10 years. What's happening out there?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I'm not sure I can actually answer that. Maybe some of the other people that have been very vested in that arena for a longer period of time than I could attest that. We are one of, as I said originally, only five states that have, you know, no limitations whatsoever. I'd like to think that despite that, that most Oregonians and most of my colleagues here still abide by the intent and appearance of clean legislation. I applaud this body and our sister body across the Capitol here for trying to not take contributions during session, which is officially allowed now the way our Constitution is interpreted and read. And I think that's a travesty. We should not be taking contributions during the legislative session for the very reasons you point out. And most Oregonians assume that's the way it is, and unfortunately that is not the current interpretation of the law. We need to make this look better, feel better, and engage Oregonians in an open dialogue.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Ringo.
Just a comment. Madam Chair, I don't think it's fair to put this, is there corruption or isn't there corruption? And did money change a vote or didn't it change a vote? It's more of the influence, and I think it's a corrupting influence on every legislator. And I mean that, on every legislator. If you turn it around and look at it the other way, what is it the special interests think they're buying when they make these campaign contributions? You can say, oh, they're just buying access. They think they're buying influence, and that's not an automatic up or down. They have a direct say in how you're going to vote, but it's an influence, and it's an influence that's damaging to the people in our state. And that's why we need to make changes, such as what considered in SGR 3 and SGR 5.
Thank you. Was that a question, Senator Ringo?
No, it was a comment.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you. I'm concerned that we are making a qualitative connection between campaign contributions and corruption.
Peter.
And I'm sorry that that is the debate that we're framing today, because I really think the issue is not about whether or not campaign contributions are connected with action or non-action by a legislator. I know my vote is not for sale, and I can't conceive of a member in this body that whose vote is for sale. And I'm sorry that people are trying to make that inference, that legislators' votes are for sale.
Yeah,
I think that's a sad commentary. I'm worried about framing the debate that connects campaign contributions with corruption. And let me just give you an example of why I think that's very sad. We had a race down on the coast between candidates for office for the Senate, which was extremely expensive to run. It was a hotly contested campaign. And I think that aggregate spending on that race on both sides approached $500,000. And those races are not uncommon in Oregon. We've had a couple in central Willamette Valley and some up in Portland that approached those amounts. If we go down the trail of connecting campaign contributions and expenditures with corruption, then it must follow that the winner must be the most corrupt. And I don't think that's the kind of statement that deserves to be made in this process. The issue in the Constitution is that the courts have held that citizens are free to make the contributions that they wish to because that's the way they express their right of free speech. And so further attempts or earlier attempts to limit people's ability to support their candidacy with their checkbook, which is the most convenient way to do that, has been held to be constitutional expression of free speech, and that's why earlier limitations failed procedurally. These measures, I think, are an attempt to modify that process and to change the Oregon Constitution so that it removes the question about whether or not campaign contributions are free speech. I think that takes us in the wrong direction. I think what Oregonians need and want is full disclosure. I think what Oregonians will be best served by is full disclosure. I'm very leery about tampering with the right that Oregonians, I think, feel is a sacred right. And that's the initiative process, the electoral process, and being able to back a candidate that they think is the best person for the office without having that system, the rules of engagement being rewritten by a political party or rewritten for because somebody doesn't like the initiative process, which is a sacred right for Oregonians, or that somebody doesn't like the outcome of elections. So I guess, Madam Chairman, you know, without asking a question, just the one statement that I'll make is that I believe it's disclosure that people really want in this process. I don't think that equating contributions and corruption is anything other than politics, Madam Chairman.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schrader, would you like to respond to that question?
I absolutely would enjoy responding to that. The good Senator and I have a long history of responsorial types of discussions. I'm afraid that while we would not like to think that corruption is not a problem, I think we have a classic case that has just arisen that's being investigated on the House side right now in the state of Oregon. This is an issue that is right before Oregonians right now. The fate of how they look at you and how they look at this process, the whole campaign process, where their campaign contributions go and how they're being used is right here, right now, before this great state. This committee has an opportunity to step forward and show that they're not inclined to not engage on the very important discussion about corruption or potential corruption or the appearance of corruption Senator Ringo again alluded to before. That's what we should be focusing on. The idea that Oregonians don't want to tamper with the lack of campaign contribution or expenditure law here in the state is respectfully incorrect. They did so over 10 years ago in a ballot initiative, which I also respect. They passed a ballot initiative that was overturned by the courts of this state. I would argue respectfully that we don't need, you know, 9 or 10 men and women deciding what happens in this state. We need Oregonians to decide. They were overwhelmingly in favor of limiting campaign and expenditures and contributions. Now, we need to get back to what Oregonians want. Now, we have to put it in a framework that respects free speech, and that's the reason we have to pass this initially and then come back with some limits, both on contributions and expenditures, that reflect what's appropriate under our U.S. Supreme Court and Constitution. I think to not do that, it would be a gross abrogation of our responsibilities, especially what's happening right here in this state. If we're all about trying to encourage people to step up and participate, if we're all about making this legislative body look like it is rising above politics and becoming representative of what the people of the state want, we need to get engaged right here, right now on SGR 5 or SGR 3. The playing field is not level. Right now, with no limit on contributions, one individual, one company, one union can put in so much money that the money that Ray Erwin or Sherry Anderson puts in is dwarfed in comparison. Who are they going to really listen to? Who's going to have the overwhelming influence on that person's psyche? Whether or not they vote on a particular issue or not is not the issue. It's about the appearance of undue influence in our election and legislative process. And I respectfully suggest, what is wrong with having a more level playing field? That's what Oregonians want to see. And I would really argue strongly and respectfully that the committee get behind these bills. Thank you.
Senator Schrader, before I respond to your comments, I did want to recognize, I asked Representative Peter Buckley to join us at the table since this is evolving and more into a conversation than testimony, and I just wanted to make sure he joined us in this conversation. Senator Schrader, that brings to mind two questions for me. Number one, if the allegations that what happened in the House are in fact true, it's my understanding that they would be a violation of current Oregon law, and I guess I would ask
ask you, isn't that still possible, that the same type of violation could occur with contribution and expenditure limits if a member or a candidate chose to violate the law when we had expenditure limits?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. However, I think it gets to, this is another tool in the toolbox that's being devised right now on the House side in a very bipartisan spirit by Republicans and Democrats as they bring forth new ideas to get past or limit the opportunity for that sort of thing to happen. I would argue respectfully that if the campaign contributions are limited, there's less opportunity, given the expense of campaigns in this day and age, for members to use those funds in other purposes. So I think this is just another tool in the toolbox to show Oregonians and builds on what's going on in the House right now, that we care about this system that they love and hold and respect, and we want to help them.
Senator Schrader, just to follow up, in your quest for a level playing field, wouldn't public financing of campaigns really bring us to that? If you're really trying to equalize the playing field and get as many folks involved, wouldn't public financing be the appropriate route?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, certainly that's an option. I think that's being explored, right? It's been explored in this, on a statewide basis, being explored in the Portland metropolitan area as we speak. But before we can even get to that discussion, we need to have this bill, these bills, pass in one form or another to indicate to the Supreme Court of this state that, money, unlimited money, does not equal unlimited free speech.
Representative Buckley, would you wish to testify?
That'd be great. Thank you very much. I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley from House District 5 in Southern Oregon.
It's not a question.
I'm grateful to have this chance to appear before you to voice my support for a simple amendment to the Constitution that can finally put us on the path to campaigns in Oregon, decide by what's best for our state instead of who has access to the largest checkbooks in town. I'd like to address you both in your current roles as office holders and in your past and future roles as candidates. I know you know the same facts that I do, that our inability to deal with the unchecked flow of money in Oregon politics has led to campaigns that become increasingly costly, increasingly bitter, and increasingly damaging to our ability to come together once in office to find the ways to make vital progress in education, healthcare, public safety, and economic development. We are, as has been mentioned, one of a handful of states with no limits on contributions and expenditures, and we pay a terrible price for this. I strongly believe that the way we run our campaigns for office is not only a major cause for the citizens of our state to lose faith in our government, it's also crippled our ability to adequately fund our schools, to provide health care for all Oregonians, and to make smart investments in programs that work, programs like Head Start, our community colleges, and Oregon Project Independence. The power of the large donors has reached a point where policy is dictated not by an exchange of ideas and the work towards compromise to be able to move forward, but by a fear of reprisal from an individual or an organization who can write a single check to a potential opponent and end your political career. In my view, this kind of power is 100% absolutely wrong for our democracy, it's wrong for our legislature, and it's wrong for our state. No matter what party you belong to, you must be able to see that to have a single donor write checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars in an attempt to buy the results of an election is unacceptable. On a national scene, leaders of both parties see this. Senator John McCain, Senator Russ Feingold have worked for years to set limits on federal campaigns, and their work has had an impact, and it continues still. The limits they brought about have resulted in more donors and participation in 2004 than any time in American history. Limits give the grassroots a chance. And you get right down to it, that's what democracy is all about. Let's argue the issues out at the grassroots level. Let's get off the phone and get into the town hall forums. Let's forget the endless fundraising dinners and get to the lunch at the senior center instead. Let's move away from the narrow agendas of the moneyed few and work with everything we have for the broad agenda of every child, family, community, and every business in Oregon. We can do this. It can happen here. We can have a system that works. I'm here today to ask you to place an amendment before the people of Oregon to let them decide. Do they want to continue on with what we have, the endless chase for big donations and the policies that come from that? Or do they want reasonable limits and positive changes in Oregon politics? The amendments you have before you are worth your support. We have others being introduced in the House as well, along with an amendment being prepared for the initiative process, should that route be necessary. This is an idea whose time has more than come. In a few moments, you'll hear from David Buchanan from Common Cause, who has worked on these issues for over 30 years in Oregon. He will tell you our history, and he will also help, as I hope I have, to point towards our future. The discussion is engaged, and I look forward to working with you to have an amendment passed in 2006 that allows for statutes that will follow, that will set reasonable limits on contributions and expenditures, that will allow average citizens to have an equal voice, and also allow us to make the effort to take on the sleaziest and most damaging aspects of modern campaigns, the vicious attack ads funded as supposedly independent expenditures. We can have a system that works. We can have a process that we can actually be proud of and lets us get our jobs done. A constitutional amendment is the first step. I thank you for your willingness to begin this work necessary to bring one about, and I'm more than willing to meet with you any time to assist this effort and bring true progress again to our state. And if I can make a couple brief comments after the conversation that's been held so far, I think it's important to look at not only the appearance of corruption, but how policy is factored in to the campaign contributions that come in to various candidates. If you look at health care in our state and you look at the amount of money that's been put into campaigns by the major insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, there can be a direct link tied to the fact that we do not have health care for all Oregonians now. It's not corruption, but it is an influence on policy. I'd also like to encourage you to look at the amendments being offered and parse the language down as has been suggested to make sure that we do get a system in place eventually that can address all the issues that we have in our campaigns. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Kent, did you have a question?
I'll wait till Senator Wesson speaks.
Are you here to testify on SGR 3 or 5? 391 and
393. All right, well, then I'll testify now.
Okay.
Couple of statements. So this isn't a question, but I'm glad that Senator Schrader's still here. When I ran for the House, I was outspent 4-1, and I was outspent by the lobby. The lobby picked this other guy, gave him money. He's a great guy. We're friends. But I was outspent 4-1. I ran for the Senate. The same thing happened. I ran for the Senate this time. I won 97% of the vote. I won the Democratic nomination. I won the Republican nomination. My average contribution was $10 from real people. And the establishment lobby in this building, for the most part, wrote me off, which is fine, because I was, you know, I don't know why. I don't want to get into that. But I will tell you this. The only thing I'll agree on that's been said so far is that the system is totally broken. I believe that. I believe that soft money is a significant issue, both from the national side and from inside the state. Representative Buckley brings up McCain-Feingold. In my experience, and I have quite a bit of experience at the national level at this, McCain-Feingold is a giant failure. Different point of view. Because all it does, I had a banking professor tell me one time about banking regulation, which is really similar. He used this analogy, which is really similar to campaign finance. It's like one of those carnival balloons that you blow up real long and you fold it, you regulate it, you can fold it into a rabbit, you can fold it into a dog, you can fold it into whatever, different shapes. I think the other part of the system that's broken is the fact we don't have transparency. One side of this debate, partisan, and Senator Ringo says this is what I'm about to say is a great example of why we need to have nonpartisan legislature. But one side of this debate right now has a forced union deduction or a required union deduction, which funds millions of dollars in campaigns. I mean, we don't know how much, you know, we can sit here all day and debate who raised more money, but, you know, that's a transparency problem in our system. Here's my problem with the limits if we go forward. But the body always does. This just defies logic for me. But what we always do is we always make it harder for people to serve in this building. I'll give you a case in point. Last time we said, you know, the economy of Oregon is so struggling, let's be political and cut our pay. Legislators cut our pay. And it'll be a great headline and some politicians can go out and run on the fact that they were so responsible they cut their $1,200 down to $1,190 or something ridiculous. Here's the problem with that. When you have such pathetic pay, you encourage bad behavior. And you restrict who can serve. So one of the things that irritates me about this debate, well, let's just limit what politicians can raise.
That's noble debate. But the problem is that soft money can come in a different way, and at the same time, we're making it more difficult to serve, and we're not doing anything to restrict the flow of special interests. I don't believe that the amount of money is going to change. I believe if you want real campaign finance reform, it's got to be completely transparent. You got to know where that money's coming from. We got to know how many millions of dollars are going in unions, and you guys have got to know how many dollars are coming on in forms of soft money. We'd like to know where your soft money comes from. You know, I'm not opposed to that. I just think that what we really have to do, Senator Schrader, I believe the system doesn't work. I don't believe that the system encourages people to participate. I believe the way that it's campaign. I'm very fortunate, and I'm not putting myself on a high pedestal or anything. I have on my desk right now a note from an 87-year-old Democrat who, on a fixed income, sent me $10. That's what you know. And I'm glad to vote against any member of the lobby. I mean, just nothing personal. It's just my style. I like that. I like the people part of this job. But transparency, I think, needs to be built in the system before we try this big McCain-Feingold feel-good thing that really doesn't restrict anything, and it makes it more hard for people to serve. Lastly, Madam Chair, I think this is a healthy debate, but I think that my Senate Joint Memorial 6 will completely smash some of the special interests in this building, change the budget process, and go a long way to restoring trust with people. So if we're going to have this debate about constitutional referrals, I would hope we would look at Senate Joint Memorial 6 and have that referral also, because that'll take money out of politics. That'll put people in front of special interests.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Either of you wish to respond?
Just, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I appreciate your testimony, and I agree. I mean, pretty much everything you said, the transparency is absolutely critical in the system. I think good Senator from Eastern Oregon also referred to that, and I agree with that. I don't think it's necessarily mutually exclusive, but I'd be a strong supporter of transparency, limiting soft money, making sure Oregonians knew exactly where the dollars are coming from to go into our campaigns. Thank you, right on. Appreciate that.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Atkinson, thank you for those comments. I also agree with transparency being absolutely essential. I think another way to look at campaign financing rather than as one balloon, but more like air pollution, that if the air is dirty, you keep trying to clean it no matter what. Even if you can only clean 80% of it, you try to clean 80% of the air. And I think it's a worthwhile effort to look at how to do that. And I do have a statute that I'm proposing to the House that I'll bring to you to take a look at that does address some of the soft money issues, and I'd love to have you co-sponsor it.
Senator Schrader, Representative Buckley, I think what troubles me about your argument is that you're saying, well, whatever, 40, 45 other states in the nation have campaign expenditure limits. I'm not seeing any difference in the credibility of the legislature or the cleanness of the legislature in those other states. And let me give you a specific example. Representative Buckley, you used health care. Okay. Oregon has had a national model in health care, the Oregon Health Plan, for a number of years. I think we could have an argument about whether it's functioning now, but at least for the last decade, we were the model in terms of health care. We, except for one election cycle, did not have campaign contribution limits or expenditures. So how did we get this national model when we didn't have campaign finance reform, A? And B, explain to me why the other legislators in all the other states with expenditure and contribution limits have higher credibility, they're more clean, all that kind of stuff, because my guess is their numbers are about the same.
I would say, with the exception possibly of Maine and Arizona, which do have a clean money system that seems to be working well for both parties and for the peoples in their state, I would respond in this way. The evolution of Oregon politics, in my view, has created sledgehammers on both sides. And if you take, for instance, what happened after Measure 30, the Republicans who were moderates, who voted for a compromise with Measure 30, were by and large taken out by fairly
extremely partisan people on each on the right side during the primaries. It's the same way, I think, if you're a Democrat, you can be taken out during a primary from a fairly partisan on the left side. And the power right now in Oregon politics belongs to the partisan groups on each extreme that have this sledgehammer they can use against any one of us. What campaign finance reform, I think, in its best model could create is more of that level playing field, so that the argument be done on the issues rather than who has that clout, that sledgehammer, particularly in the primaries. And I can see Senator Ringo going, that goes right up with his ideas and some things he would like to try to do with the primaries. So I would suggest that has had an impact on us in terms of the last decade. I'd also suggest that our credibility has taken a beating session after session because we have not been able to fund our schools. And if you look at the state of Colorado, for instance, as an example, they are a little bit further down the road than our state is. Their higher ed system is virtually bankrupt right now because they have fallen policies that have not worked, and the citizens of that state are finally rebelling against that, and they have passed significant campaign finance reform that is having an impact on how they elect people for office. They're getting policies that work for their state.
Okay. Well, I would argue that the reason in Colorado that the higher ed system is in so much trouble is because of the Tabor Amendment, but that's another conversation. Senator Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You raised, as usual, some very thoughtful comments, and I guess that I'd like to see some work done to look at how other states are viewed in some detail by their respective constituents that have limits. I'd also point out, though, that in my, and again, this is somewhat anecdotal, but one of the things I'm most proud about our state in is our voter turnout. Historically, we've always had a very, very high turnout in this state. People participate. I think that while sometimes state legislature has dubious credibility, the system has had some pretty darn good credibility in the past. I don't like things slipping. Certainly there are certain campaigns, and as we've seen recently, that will excite Oregonians and Americans, and they'll participate in a greater way. But some of these states, I think that their credibility is probably suspect, but they're also very apathetic. I mean, when South Carolina has 15% of the people showing up at the polls electing a leadership, I'm sure they're all over campaign limits and contributions limits for contributions and expenditures because they feel they're totally distanced from the system. I think that this sort of thing encourages participation and credibility. The Senate of the state of Oregon right now, this session is embarked upon a big campaign to improve Oregonians' participation, to dispel the apathy that we see out there and improve the credibility of the state legislature. This is just one more tool, one more indication that this body is willing to step up and do everything in its power to show Oregonians that we are credible, we care about what they think, we want a very level playing field, and we want this to continue to be, hopefully, the cleanest state in the nation as far as campaigns go.
Thank you. Anyone else? Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, it's nice to sit here and listen to the cure-all. I'm in the in the old days, we used to watch the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, and we'd hear Geritol would cure neuritis and neuralgia. And here we're hearing that these two SJRs will cure every ill that afflicts the malaise in the Oregon political system. I'm interested to know why it is that if there was such a beneficial effect of limiting contributions and such a corrosive effect, why George Soros had such an easy time dumping billions of dollars into the electoral process recently. And I will correct a record. Most of the moderates who voted for Measure 30 were hired by the governor, not removed from office. Check the record. I still think this issue is tampering with the electoral process. So many of us in the building ran under limitations of spending. We had the $30,000 limitation for the primary, $60,000 limitation for the general in expenditure, and $100 campaign contribution limitations, individuals only. In that race, the Oregon Education Association spent $75,000 to try to defeat me in that general election, and I have to admit, Madam Chairman, that spending did affect my thinking. It may still affect my thinking.
Thank you, Senator.
But that perhaps not in the way that money and influence are supposed to be connected. None of that mattered. as the good senator from wherever the good senator is from now that it's been redistricted out of his own district, mentioned that many of us run in districts where either we didn't have opposition or we didn't have to raise a great deal of money for our own campaigns. I just think that the issue isn't whether or not people are limited in the way they can support a candidacy. Is as important as the full disclosure issues. And if you want to work on something that I think will help Oregonians understand the political process, the clear indication for me is that the tragedy that played itself out in the House will be dealt with under existing statutes, as the chairman aptly pointed out, and that the issue that made that possible was full disclosure and diligence by individuals who looked at the public record. I think the Secretary of State's to be commended on the activities that he's engaged in, and that's making those records much more interactive, much more searchable, and much more immediate. Those are the kind of things that matter. This is just a Band-Aid or a window dressing. It seems to me not to be a substantive change. You're not going to. People are very creative. The reason that the OEA was able to spend $74,000 to try to defeat me is that they found a way around any limitation that you want to put up there. And political money is like water. It'll take the path of least resistance. I don't think you're going to solve the problem with these SJRs. Disclosure is the key, and transparency is the key to solving the problem and building credibility. Just my opinion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferriero. We look forward to having your assistance on a number of disclosure bills that will be coming for us. Any further questions for these two? I think Senator Schrader.
Madam Chair, I have to have 20 seconds more comment.
Okay.
I don't think these are intended to solve the problem. They're intended to allow us to have the discussion. That's all they are. They don't have any specifics. The specifics we can debate for days on days on days, but right now we're prevented from even having a real analysis of what might work because of what's in the Constitution. So they're not intended to solve the problem. They're intended to let us talk about it.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. Senator Schrader, Representative Buckley, thank you very much for coming before us this morning. We appreciate your time.
Appreciate the committee's interest.
I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 5. People in the audience, don't panic. I've got Senator Westland here to testify on two bills. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bills 391 and 393 and ask the committee administrator to tell us a little bit about these bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 391 allows county assessors and county treasurers to be appointed by county commissioners rather than elected, and that would apply to counties of a population of 100,000 or more. Senate Bill 393 would allow non-residents of certain special districts to vote in district elections and to serve on district boards, provided that they meet certain statutory criteria.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Westland. Sorry to keep you waiting.
I appreciate very much you squeezing me in here.
Okay.
I am Senator Ben Westland, District 27, from Central Oregon. With regard to two bills, here to testify on behalf of two bills. First up, Senate Bill 391. If we could set that over, Madam Chair, there's a little constitutional issue here. Included in the bill to make the assessor and treasurer of certain described counties an appointed position. The treasurer runs afoul of this document we all know and love as a constitution. It's a constitutionally addressed issue, so we cannot include both of those offices in the same legislation, so we'll be drafting separate legislation. So if we just set that over until we hear back from LC, I think that would be the appropriate move at this time with regard to Senate Bill 391.
Thank you. Senator Westland, the problem I have is that I have a number of folks, including Michael Long, who came from Klamath Falls, and Sam Huff, and Ron Northroff, who came from Douglas County, that are here. So if it's not too uncomfortable for you, I'd like to at least have them testify in the record since they're here and have traveled a long distance.
I think that's most appropriate, okay. Madam Chair, and I think maybe for discussion purposes, if we could just concentrate on the appointment of the assessor, that's probably the bill that would actually have a legitimate chance of going forward in this process. So
okay.
I think that's very appropriate. If you'd like me to continue on 391 with regard to appointing the assessor, this is quite simply a bill to streamline and make government more efficient. Many of these assessors today, it's a very technical and specific job skill that is being desired by our county commissioners and indeed the citizens of any given county. The issue remains, and I think it's maybe somewhat opportune to your prior discussion on campaign finance reform. It's really whoever runs the best campaign wins the assessor's position, and in many regards that has no particular bearing on the specific job skills of the quote candidate versus the employee that under Senate Bill 391 would be a hired position, serve at the pleasure of elected officials. It's not like the people are being cut out of this process. And that's the purpose of, or at least the assessor part on 391.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Senator Westline? Thank you.
Thank you. Want me to sit back down and...
No, I opened a public hearing for Senate Bill 393 as well. So.
Okay. And with regard to the special districts, Senate Bill 393, again, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, what we're trying to do with this bill is extend to citizens who live in certain areas but outside of the city limit but are still within what our Secretary of State would call communities of interest. Extend to those citizens that own property in a special taxing district the ability to, A, vote in those elections, so they aren't disenfranchised, and, B, serve in a leadership capacity on, in this case, the district water board. We've limited the geographic area to 10 miles. And, again, I think the key here is that these citizens don't live inside the district, own property within that district, but are excluded both in terms of voting and leadership potential from participating in their community by a significant barrier, but only by really a geographic line on a map. So I urge your further consideration of the special districts bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Westland. Any questions for Senator Westland?
Thank you, Madam.
Senator Ferrioli.
Senator Westland, through the chair, I can think of an instance where, for instance, a landowner exists outside of an irrigation district and has a necessarily has a dispute with the management of the water district or wants to change the direction of the water district. Would that person under this bill be allowed to vote within the water district, not residing within the water district?
Does he receive water from the irrigation district?
On the lands within the district, yes.
If he does, then he is already a voting member of that irrigation district.
And could also have...
Already.
Yes, and Madam Chairman, for following. Okay. And could also serve on the board?
That, yes.
Okay.
Well, that situation is already accounted for.
Okay.
In irrigation districts.
And the Madam Chair.
But it is specifically separate than water districts for incorporated or non-incorporated areas where a citizen owns property within that district but is precluded from voting or participating in leadership functions such as the board by his geographic residence.
And Madam Chair, just one follow-up. How are special districts differentiated from districts such as municipalities? In other words, would this give the authority to an individual who lives outside of the city limits but owns a business or a property within the city limits the ability to and pays taxes on that Madam Chairman, would that give that person the ability to vote within the city or run for city council or other city office?
Fair question. No, it would not.
Okay. And Madam Chairman, final question.
Sure.
Are the special districts enumerated so that the folks that are interested in this bill can figure out which districts are affected by the bill?
Maybe staff could help me with that question. I do not have a specific answer, but I think that's a fair question, one that should at the very least be ferreted out and clarified if there is a concern over that issue.
Okay. ORS Chapter 198. I should say that on the record.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the special districts are enumerated in ORS Chapter 198.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Any further questions for Senator Laughlin? Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify and working me in. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Obviously, the Special Districts Association and so on will be testifying on these bills later, right?
I have a list of the Association of County Clerks, Annette Newingham, to testify, and that's it. So I'm actually, because we are on public hearing in 393, I'm going to ask Annette to come on up.
Okay.
Hi.
I'm in debt.
Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annette Newingham. I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I am the Lane County Elections Official. And I wanted to comment on this because there are concerns of the association. It was really unclear how these individuals would be identified and what to whom would reside outside of the district boundaries. Currently, the election systems are all designed to be district defined, and we identify that based on the address ranges that exist, and that allows people to vote, and that puts the ballot types together for us to mail out the ballots. There is a provision for them to come in and bring a certificate, but the issue that we were concerned about is how, when they came in, we wouldn't even have a ballot style for that combination because it didn't exist in the district, and we'd have to maybe give them a paper ballot. Then how do we tabulate that to appropriate into that district? And the other questions that we had would be, how would these individuals know who they were? We probably would need to know who they were and what kind of notification would be given to them. It just seems a little unclear how that process would efficiently work in the system that we currently have, because we really base it on actual defined district boundaries, and this would be very different than anything that any election official currently does. I would certainly would want to encourage the whoever is sponsoring the bill to maybe work with the Association of County Clerks to try to figure out how we could do this in an accurate and efficient way and in a way that people were notified, and how we could tabulate the votes accurately, because we always are very concerned about the perception of things not being done accurately or adequately, and this could be a little confusing.
Thank you, Ms. Newingham. Is there any questions for her? Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Next up, Ms. Haseem Squires.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Haseem Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm not really fully prepared to testify on all the merits because I really wasn't sure what the issue was and what the problem was that is trying to be solved in Senate Bill 393. But from hearing Senator Westland's testimony, I understand it to be an issue of representation on boards of directors for residents who live outside of the district, and ability to vote on measures that take place in the district if you're a property owner. And yes, irrigation district statutes are completely separate from election statutes are separate from 255, which governs ORS 198 special districts. Just raise a couple of concerns. Our legislative committee hasn't taken a position or looked at this bill. A couple of concerns, though, or questions. Some of not all of the special districts are listed in this bill, so it appears to be water, sewer, sanitary authorities, and rural fire protection districts. So I thought for a moment that it was utilities we were after, but it appears that there are other districts, particularly rural fire protection districts. property owners have typically have some, if it's a non-piece of vacant land, have renters. So then are we having one issue? Is, are we having a person who lives on the property vote in the district and then the property owner also gets to vote? And is that two votes or one vote for one piece of property? That would be one concern I think we would have. Why it doesn't apply, as Senator Ferrioli brought up, to cities. I live in unincorporated, and it also applies to unincorporated territory. So if you're a special district, because a lot of special districts provide services to cities, but this legislation clearly articulates property outside the boundaries of a city and the operations and facilities of the joint, whatever, it, or of the facility, which operations and which facilities. Some districts will have their administrative office in one place and have their facilities in another place. I just have questions about how that would work, and I think the clerk from Wayne County has probably some of the same questions that we have about how this would be administered and what the, actually really what the problem is we're trying to solve. And you know, and
thank you.
I appreciate
that's
you raising those concerns.
That's the sum
total of my testimony, and I apologize.
Okay.
It's
that's
just
okay.
A confusing
Sarah,
issue.
Do you have any thoughts?
Okay. All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 393, and I'm going to open I had the public hearing open on 391, but we're going to reopen it. And I would ask, I have three assessors in the group, Ray Erlin, Ron Northrath, and Douglas Ebner. Come on forward, please.
They're going to give us their assessment of the bill.
That is correct, Senator Shields. We were waiting for you to come alive with your puns this session, but clearly you were a sleeping giant.
Clearly you haven't been listening for the last 3 weeks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Ebner. It's an honor to be here today. And I represent the Marion County, I am the Marion County Assessor and also represent, I'm president of the Oregon Association of County Assessors. On behalf of the association, we would like to thank the committee for allowing us the opportunity to be here today and testify to you on Senate Bill 391, which authorizes the governing body of the county to appoint the county assessor in counties where the population is more than $100,000.
Oh, now we're down to the heart of the matter.
Now we're down to the money. You probably won't find us dealing with campaign finance because we don't generally get a lot of money and we are a grassroots organization, so I just wanted to clarify that before I'm on.
Thank you, Mr. Ebner.
Counties operate on self-governing entities through locally elected officials. The framers of the Oregon Constitution understood the need for that sharing of power by designating certain officers as elected positions. Some have specified in the Constitution and some are statute. They understand very well the problem associated with the centralization of political power. The citizens also provide a means for counties to change the organizational structure in their government by presenting a plan for home rule. Home rule is involved in some counties now. Marion County has tried to make home rule through the Board of Commissioners a number of times. It failed every time because the public still wants to vote on the county assessor and the treasurer and the county clerk. Those are important issues to them. A number of counties have presented home rule charters to their citizens. The home rule process provides the citizens the opportunity to discuss and review all of the functions of county government and how the balance of power should be distributed. Some counties have chosen to have a county administrator, which appoints rather than elected officials. Others have continued to elect officers. Both organizational styles have worked well for the citizens in those counties. However, when only one office is considered, such as the assessor, the opportunity to review the total structure of the citizens is lost. In Oregon, nine counties have chosen the home rule structure of government. The citizens of those counties have reviewed the functions of county government, and only five of them have agreed to make the assessor appointed. The rest of them have stayed elected. The current system of 31 elected and 5 appointed assessors is working well. The quality of both the elected and appointed assessors have been stronger than ever. During the 1990s, the assessors had a difficulty in the task of implementing Measure 5 and Measure 50. While both measures were complex and dramatically changed the Oregon property tax system, assessors demonstrated the required skills and expertise to effectively make the changes and communicate with their citizens. During this period, new assessors came on board, and they, too, had the necessary skills to adopt and manage the assessor's process. Most of us who have been elected as assessors have grown up through the system. We know property tax. We've been in real estate. We know what we feel we're qualified. And the citizens of the county feel we're qualified, and that's why we're sitting here today in office. The same reason that you're sitting there in office today, because you were elected by your citizens to represent them. And I think that's really important that we keep that electrical process going. In summary, the current system is not broken. We believe the current form of government within the county works well, and that this legislation would weaken county government, not strengthen it. We ask the community to permanently table Senate Bill 391. Respectfully, Doug Ebner, County Assessor.
Thank you.
And Madam Chairman,
Senator Ferriello.
I'm sorry, which county?
Marion County.
Marion County.
Part of my district.
Part of your district.
30, Madam Chairman.
You have our East End.
You cover many counties, Senator Ferrioli. Okay, who would like to go next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ray Erling, Clackamas County Assessor. I would just add briefly to the previous testimony. Senator Westland said that the assessor's position is a technical job. We agree with that. But the assessors have a history of qualified individuals becoming assessors since 1990. 20 new assessors have taken office. Most had experience in the office. 4 were elected that had no direct experience. They've all shown the ability and necessary skills to manage the office effectively. The current system isn't broken. Citizens already have a mechanism through Home Rule Charter to review and change the structure of the local county government. I believe this legislation is not needed, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thanks, Mr. Erwin. Last but not least, Senator.
Question, Madam Chairman.
Sure.
And that was from which county?
Clackamas County.
Also part of District 30, Madam Chairman.
Actually, Senator Ferriello, I am lucky enough to have a part of Clackamas County as well in my district. I think everybody has a piece of Clackamas County.
And we all want a piece of it.
Is that a result of gerrymandering in the redistricting process?
I don't know, Senator Ferriello. Mr. Northrath.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity of being here. I'm Ron Northcraft, Douglas County Assessor. I've been in that position for 6 years. 1 month ago, I was elected the first Vice President of the Oregon Association of County Assessors. I have 3 points to make. 1, there is currently qualifications to hold that office. As mentioned by Mr. Irwin, those qualifications have led to a qualified pool that currently hold those positions. The citizens of Douglas County have elected me twice to that position, to this position. I'm not certain that I would be there had it been an appointed position. And I think that it's also ironic that at this time we are considering removing the right of the citizens to vote when we are currently in Iraq today with over 150,000 of our citizens from our country. Not all citizens, but they are trying to extend that right of voting to the electorate of that country. My last point is that a vote against this would avoid the consolidation of power. In our county, placing the vote in commissioners to appoint would remove approximately 20,000 electorates the opportunity to vote for the assessor. I would urge your vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming to be here this morning. Any questions? Senator Shields.
Just very quickly, do all of the counties that do this election of the assessor have that set of qualifications or criteria as part of the background against which people vote on the candidates?
That's a statewide, by statute,
okay.
The education and experience requirements are statewide.
Even once we get in, there's a certain amount of educational requirements to be a manager and run the office are required for us, so we have ongoing education constantly.
Madam Chair, maybe this is an unfair question to ask you or staff, but why does the bill come forward when in statute there are qualifications that, you know, seem to mitigate the need for the bill?
Well, Sarah Shields, I think we could Senator Westland ask that these bills have a hearing. So, you want to respond to that in some way?
I can try to do that, sure. I mean, it's true that there already are some statutory requirements for the qualifications of candidates for the position of assessor, and that's in ORS Chapter 204. So I don't have enough background information to comment on what additional qualifications the bill would bring.
Well, Madam Chair, it just seems to me that the only thing left is maybe job performance review or something like that that you would have if you hired that person and that person was a, you know, subject to that kind of thing. But if you want to carry it to another step, job performance review would be once every 4 years at the ballot box. So, you know, again, I'm having some trouble finding out why we've got this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here this morning. I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 391. Treasurer's in the audience. We're going to take a quick break here and open a work session on bill introductions. We have a number of bill introductions to do. Some, I think, were intended to be introduced as Senate Rules Committee, but others were simply did not get introduced yesterday in time for the deadline. The chair would move the introductions of LC 34, LC 100, LC 853, LC 956, LC 1269, LC 1270, LC 1285, LC 1296, LC 1596, LC 1597, LC 1611, LC 1778, LC 1989, LC 1996, LC 2000, LC 2017, LC 2018, LC 2021, LC 2022, LC 2065, LC 2066, LC 2070, LC 2071, LC 2111, LC 2167, LC 2168, LC 2230, LC 2247, LC 2514, LC 2524, LC 2624, LC 2693, LC 2723, LC 2755, LC 2776-1, LC 2777. Committee members should have a list of the relating clauses regarding these bills, and the sent the information is available, the requester of the bill. Again, your vote is not in support or in opposition to any of these measures. It's simply for the purposes of introducing these LC drafts as bills.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farrielly.
Madam Chairman, in reviewing these LC relating clauses, I see a rather eclectic mix of introductions here. And from that mix, I would conclude that the Chairman has made the opportunity to introduce bills to this committee rather universal. And so I would just suggest if anyone wonders why there's this great gap of introductions, this has more to do with the timing of the deadline yesterday than any other thing. Madam Chairman, I would just express appreciation for the rather ecumenical manner in which you have received the LC draft for this committee.
I thank you, Senator Farrielly. I think eclectic is an understatement in terms of the list of bills before us. You are correct that some of the bill requests are due to members not simply not getting their bills in, but consider this a forewarning. This Senate committee has the ability to draft bills and introduce bills at any time, but as we did last session, Senator Carno and I worked very closely to restrict that so we weren't having bills continuing to be drafted. So we will encourage folks that want bill drafts at this point to seek relating clauses, to seek another vehicle, and bring to the chair good circumstances, show cause why you didn't get your bill drafted already at this point in time. And I understand that emergencies come up, et cetera. But after this week, you will see Bill both drafting requests and introductions being severely and substantially reduced.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, the only one that I would question is LC 2514 relating to food.
Cause of action related to food.
Right.
Okay.
It's like a rather broad topic.
Well, we know that our colleagues in the House are doing an incredible job restricting relating clauses, so we anticipate that when folks are looking for vehicles that they'll be coming to the Senate side as opposed to the House side. Would the committee staff please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Excused.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Thank you for your cooperation. And with that, we'll reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 191 and ask the treasurers in the room to come forward and briefly give your remarks on Senate Bill 391. Ms. Sherry Anderson, Mr. Michael Long, Ms. Michelle Hawkins, Ms. Lori Steele, and Mr. Sam Huff. And I don't know if you guys want to grab other chairs in the front row and all sit up, but... And for those of you in the room waiting on SJR 3 and 5, we'll come back to those following the testimony on Senate Bill 391. Understand me? Excuse.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields isn't going to be here. You're not going to be here, and I'm not going to be here.
Right. I'm going to go ahead and stay. So you guys go ahead and be excused. So thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I think we'll keep this pretty brief since... Moving on quickly. Just a couple of things that I would like to. I'm Sherry Anderson. I'm the treasurer of Clackamas County, once again an elected treasurer. And one of a few major points, the Home Rule Charter. The option to do what Deschutes County would like to do with this already exists through a Home Rule Charter. In fact, this proposed legislation only applies to 9 counties which have populations in excess of 100,000. Of those 9, 4 are already home rule charters. So you're looking at legislation that simply applies to 5 counties, Deschutes County being one. This is not a new proposal. It's different. 2 years ago, we were testifying in front of the House, a House General Government Committee on a similar bill. Deschutes County cannot get a home rule charter. That is why this keeps coming up. It failed in 2000, 66% to 27%. And so this is their attempt to go around the home rule charter. Again, the people in Clackamas County have the right currently to vote for a county treasurer and a county assessor, a clerk, a sheriff, and 3 county commissioners. And under this proposed legislation, the commissioners at any point in time could decide that the people of Clackamas County no longer have that right. And I think that the people of Clackamas County deserve to at least have the right to decide whether they have that right any longer. There's nothing in this legislation that says every 4 years the commissioners couldn't change their mind. Today they could decide tomorrow to make the position appointed. 10 years from now, if we have a different board of commissioners, they could decide to make the position elective again. So there's nothing in it that precludes vacillating back and forth. Again, it also doesn't, there's a constitutional issue which we had already become aware of with the county treasurer, because the Constitution requires each county to have an elected county treasurer. So there would have to be an amendment to the Constitution in order for this to pass, which would have to go statewide. And also, it doesn't define anything about vacancy. It says this legislation would take effect when a vacancy occurs in the office. I'm not sure when a vacancy occurs. Perhaps it's more well known when that would happen, but as long as I assume people keep running for the position, if there's an incumbent in office, I'm not sure when that vacancy would occur. So that's my testimony. I urge you to oppose this, as do I. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Michelle Hawkins, and I'm the Linn County Treasurer, and I am affected by this bill. But I'm here actually to let you know that back in the early 80s, we had home rule come up on our election 2 different times, and both times it was voted down by 90%. Linn County is a very, I want to say, a county that votes, that takes their voting very seriously. Our last election, we had 92% turnout. Most of the time when our law enforcement levy comes up, it's 75% turnout. So our county is very much into the voting right. I would hate to say that we would go to them and say, oh, by the way, we passed a bill that said we took that right away from you, because I know that they would be up here screaming and yelling saying that you should not have done that. So I am here on their behalf, also with my behalf, and I would like you to oppose it.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here.
Sam Huff, Douglas County. I am also against the bill. Douglas County has tried off and on. People talk about a home rule. It always fades away, so I believe the people really aren't interested in changing the structure of our county, and I urge you to vote no.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I thought the D.C. stood for Washington, D.C., so instead of Douglas County. So
it would be a long drive.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lori Steele, the Marion County Treasurer. I'm also elected, and I'm here today to oppose this bill as well. I've left a letter for you, and I just wanted to let you know that in Marion County, the voters have also declined to use a home rule charter in Marion County more than once, and I think that the voters have spoken in Marion County. The commissioners in Marion County will also be getting a letter to you expressing their opposition to this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Mike Long. I'm the Klamath County Treasurer in Klamath Falls. Now, this bill does not affect me because we're a population around 67,000, but it can end up affecting all the, if once you get it into one level, then you can change it. But our county has also had vote for home charter. It was voted down 3-1 in 1995. They're very strong in having their vote, so I'm against this, and it's because I'm supporting these counties that are against it. So I wanted to go on record that we as treasurers of the smaller counties do support that. I'm the former past president of the Treasurers Association, so representing all the smaller counties, they've asked me to kind of speak for them in opposition. And I'm also the second vice president of the National Association of County Treasurers representing Oregon.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions, sir?
Madam Chairman, I do. I think the public well understands that there is a dynamic tension between treasurers, assessors, and the elected body of the counties. That the treasurers and the tax assessors often are of a different mind than the county boards of commissions or the county judges, and that the duly elected treasurers and duly elected tax assessors have a watchdog role that they play for the public. And that is just a critical element. For instance, with regard to the assessors, they determine valuation, process, adjudicate appeals, and collect taxes. With the treasurers, they are required to account for the expenditures and the income and make the appropriate reports as required. There's endless opportunity for mischief in these processes, and the citizens really value the opportunity to hold those elected officials accountable, to listen to the quality of their debate, and to vote for the person that they think has the best qualifications to do a job, and to uphold an oath, which is to the Oregon Constitution. And I just think it's not a good idea to allow local government to say whom you can vote for. Next thing you know, Madam Chairman, they'll be telling people whether or not they can make campaign contributions. It's just not American, Madam Chairman.
I was curious how these folks felt on the campaign finance reform issue, but I won't put you on the record right now. I just really appreciate you coming. We appreciate your input, and you'll see what happens if the bill gets scheduled any further. So I would also encourage you to contact Senator Westland's office and let him know your strong feelings on the bill.
Thank you
very much.
Madam Chairman, there's a half-price sale on Valentine's today. Send us to Senator Westland's.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 391 and reopen a hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 3 and Senate Joint Resolution 5. And if I find the list, what did I do with the list?
Here.
Oh, you got it. Okay. Thank you. Invite...
Yeah. Oh, what a coincidence. I'm going to invite Mr. Terrell, Mr. Buchanan, Ms. Eaton, and Ms. Kolos up. Is it Kalis? Kalis, I'm sorry. Up to testify on both SJR 3 and 5. We've got Sarah Weatherson on deck, Andrea Meyer, and Dan Meek in the hall.
No problem. Please proceed in whatever order you find comfortable.
Mr. Chair and committee, what there's left of it. I'm Norman Turrell, speaking on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I am a state league board member and a member of the League's Action Committee, where I hold the campaign finance portfolio. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. And yes, Mr. Chairman, men are invited to become members of the League, too. I also am chair of the Oregon Building Better Campaigns Coalition. Furthermore, the Washington State Campaign Contribution Limits Law was derived from the 1992 Initiative 582. I was the founder, co-chair, and chief drafter of the Cures Coalition that wrote and promoted Initiative 582 in Washington State. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss SJR 3 and SJR 5. We would be delighted if either of these bills passed the legislature. I will leave it to my colleagues here at the table to discuss the history and technical details of these proposals. I want to discuss the motivation. The League has long supported campaign finance reform in Oregon. Our position on campaign finance states that methods of financing political campaigns should ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum citizen participation in the political process. In spite of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions to the contrary, the Oregon Supreme Court has interpreted Oregon's Constitution as barring limits on campaign contribution. Therefore, we need an amendment of Oregon's Constitution in order to allow such limits. Free speech is guaranteed by Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, and we cherish that right. But nowhere in the Constitution does it say that any citizen has the right to contribute any amount of money to political candidates or to attempt to buy influence over or access to public officials. By changing the Constitution to allow limits on campaign contributions, we are taking the first step towards putting Oregon on a course to make our political campaigns fairer and open to more candidates and more citizen supporters. We are also starting down a road that potentially will free candidates to use their campaign time for informing the public rather than raising money, while also freeing them from feeling any obligation to large donors. Now is the time to take this first step. Recent examples of alleged misuse of campaign contributions have raised doubts in the public's mind about trusting legislators with campaign funds. Unfortunately, this has led to questions about the ability of legislators to handle the state's budget as well. Citizens and legislators alike are poorly served when citizens mistrust their elected officials. It is in the interest of all of us to restore public trust and to improve Oregon's political campaigns. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like Dave Buchanan to go next, and then Cappy Eaton and Tina Kalos.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Buchanan. I'm the state chairman of Oregon Common Cause.
Common Cause is an organization that was founded in the late 60s by John Gardner, who had been the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And as an academic in his career, he got back to Washington, D.C., and his remark was, "I found everybody here represented except the people." So after he left service in the a cabinet, he founded an organization that he called Common Cause, and it became a citizens' lobby. And shortly after its founding, Common Cause found a cause to support, and that was campaign finance reform in the wake of the Watergate scandals. Common Cause has been working on campaign finance reform ever since. It's a problem that still hasn't been resolved. The beginnings of campaign financing regulation in Oregon go back almost 100 years. In 1908, the voters, through an initiative, passed a corrupt Practices in Campaigns Act, and that put some limits on what candidates and contributions could be made. The limitation was a 10% of the annual compensation, or $100, and this was per election. And that that law served Oregon for almost a half a century and stayed in effect. And then in 1957, the legislature, improving on the original initiative, raised the dollar limits from $100 to $250. But saw fit to keep the program of having those kinds of limitations. Another 14 years went by. In 1971, the legislature again raised the dollar limits and also kind of streamlined the language, because some of the language from the early part of the century was a little bit quaint by that point. They talked about limitations on descendants, ascendants, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, spouses, partners, employers, or a fellow official or employee in a corporation. So in 71, that language was cleaned up a little bit, and the contribution limitations were restricted to those that the candidate, for which the candidate was personally liable, and made by spouses, partners, and employers and employees. So the legislature again responded by keeping the system but cleaning up the language, as well as raising the dollar amounts again. Then in 1973, a major change, and the reason for that was that Watergate had informed the subject of campaign finance regulation, and the 73 legislature took a new look at the whole subject, and instead of trying to regulate contributions, their judgment expressed itself in a new law that said, instead of contribution limitations, let's do expenditure limitations. And I know the terminology is a little bit vague, because a contribution and expenditure look the same depending on which direction of the transaction you're looking at. But in effect, a contribution coming from an individual to a candidate versus an expenditure from a candidate spending money on his campaign. So the 73 law abolished all of the contribution regulations and put in place instead expenditure limits, telling candidates it doesn't really matter where you get your contributions from, you can choose whatever mix of contributions you like, but the fairness element is preserved by having equitable limitations on how much each candidate would spend, so that there wouldn't be a case where one candidate would be outspending another by magnitudes of 4 or 5 to 1. But the reality is that it prevents the expenditures from the range of 50 or 100 or several hundred to one. So the 73 law created a system of spending limits based on the amount of money times the number of voters in a district, and those formulas produced numbers that are absolutely quaint today, because the statewide dollar limitation was about $180,000, the limitations for congressional districts was about $45,000, Senate districts just under $10,000, House districts just under $5,000. The actual dollar amounts are perfectly subject to adjustment to match the current circumstances, but the concept is what's important. Now, that law was challenged, and in fact, there was even a court ruling in October of 74, just prior to the 74 election, and the decision was kind of a split decision, and both sides appealed the outcome, and the stalemate caused by that allowed the 1974 election to be conducted under the rules of the spending limitations, which is what happened. After the 74 election was over, then the Supreme Court did make a pronouncement overturning the spending limitations portion of the the entire portion of the law, because contribution limits were already excluded from the new law. So in 1974, an election was held with spending limitations in effect. My read on that election is it was not materially different from the elections before and after, meaning that if you were looking for a particular bias of the outcome, spending limitations didn't favor one side or the other. It simply made less money in the process. Now, after the 75 court decision, there were another series of efforts to make additional changes. There was a 1976 ballot measure, which was in effect kind of a pioneering effort. It was partial public funding, and it was defeated at the polls. But I think so. The authors of that particular initiative were Hardy Myers and Hans Lindy, and they both argue for the merits of that system. After the defeat of that initiative in 76, then there were a number of legislative efforts, none of which were completely successful. Some issues, the Senate would pass a bill, but the House not. Sometimes the House would pass a bill and the Senate not. One case, the House and the Senate both passed a bill and the governor vetoed it. So on through the 80s, we had many efforts to try and re-regulate campaign financing in Oregon, but none were completely successful. And then in the early 90s, another effort to do an initiative were then put forward, and let me defer now to Cappy for the 1994 initiative effort.
Thank you, David. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, for the record, I'm Cappy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I'm going to bring you up to date, sort of, as it were. In the 20-year period between 1972 and 1992, the cost of running for the House and the Senate increased tenfold. In other words, in 1972, it cost $3,000 to run for a seat in the Oregon House. By 1992, it had increased to $30,000 to run for a seat in the House. So in an effort to curb what the public began to look at as runaway campaign expenses, the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and Osberg and the American Party, which had arisen out of the fact that Perot got 19% of the vote in Oregon in 1992, decided to look at contribution limits. And by 1994, they put a measure on the ballot, an initiative, that went through the legislature halfway. The Oregon Senate in 1993 did indeed pass a contribution limits, but the House refused to hold any hearings, and so an initiative drive was mounted, and it passed by 71% across the state. It was very successful. The people in Oregon were saying it's getting too costly to run for public office. The 1995 legislature, both the House and the Senate Rules Committees, made some effort to modify but was measure 9, unsuccessfully, fortunately. There were 72 pages of amendments that were proposed in the House. And the point was that we felt that we should go through an election cycle with the contribution limits in place and see what happened, and then modify it if we needed to, because it was a statute. So what happened in 1996 was that the cost of running for office in Oregon declined by two-thirds. In other words, the contribution limits did what they were supposed to, and there were one-third more people who contributed to campaigns. So the idea of trying to create a level playing field with more members of the public contributing smaller amounts actually worked. However, in the meantime, the lawsuit had been filed, and in February of 1997, the Supreme Court threw out the contribution limits, saying that it's not allowed under the Oregon Constitution. There were voluntary spending limits also in that ballot measure, and they were left in place at that point. So in 1997, another small group, and you may recall, Senator Brown, you convened that group to begin to talk about public funding. And out of that group, which had a fairly was a fairly large coalition, again, there was an initiative which was to require and put in place public funding for the legislature and the statewide offices in Oregon. It polled quite well. Unfortunately, it was defeated at the polls. So what we have now in Oregon is disclosure. And we need the disclosure, but we also feel that looking at the track record in other states, some of which have a combination of contribution limits and public funding, they seem to create a much more level playing field than we have. And so we now come before you with the question of the debate on should we have constitutional limits on contributions.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton. Senator Ferraioli has a question, so
thank
before
you,
we
Chair.
Move on to Ms. Kalos.
Madam Chairman, Ms. Eaton testified that in 1996 the contributions declined by two-thirds.
No, I said the expenditures for the elections, the cost of the elections declined by two-thirds.
Madam Chairman, I think that would be only the amount reported by the candidates declined. I'm almost certain that the amount of money spent in the elections
the total amount of
increased.
Money that was spent in the independent expenditure side
yes.
increased,
yes.
but it's still the cost of elections in 1996 was less than it had been in 1994 or 1998.
Madam Chairman, I can't reconcile those two concepts. If the cost of the elections increased, but it was just the contributions reported by candidates that decreased, the difference must have been in the independent expenditures. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out here, Madam Chairman, is whether or not the cost of the elections actually declined, or it just drove the spending into the independent expenditure cost.
Senator Ferraioli, the data shows that the actual cost of the election in 1996 was less than it was in 1994.
And then
total, including the independent expenditures and
including the independent expenditures. The independent expenditures increased, but they did not overcome the two-thirds less that went into the contributions.
Madam Chair, I'd be interested in seeing the comparative data.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether or not there was an awful lot of expenditures that never were reported.
Mr. Terrell.
We have a speaker coming up from MIPRAP that will show you the actual data from that election.
Great. Okay.
I have it too, but I'll let her take care
okay.
of it.
Okay. Ms. Kalos?
My name is Tina Kalos.
Okay.
I've been
sorry.
Working with the Building Better Campaigns Coalition and am a member of the State Board of Common Cause, on whose behalf I speak today. I moved from Arizona to Oregon 3 years ago. While in Arizona, I was an attorney on the legal team that successfully defended Arizona's landmark clean election system from numerous constitutional challenges. And I want to say I am, based on the experience there of being very closely involved with the implementation, a strong supporter of a system similar to that, and I understand that that is being considered in Portland. My fear is, and it's been stated by a number of people that they feel that we believe that contribution limits are a kind of a the ultimate solution to campaign finance problems, and that is definitely not true. I view contribution limits as basically a step toward a public financing system. And the reason is because contribution limits lower the cost of campaigns. And if you compare Oregon and the cost of campaigns here with the cost of campaigns in states of similar size elsewhere, and I can talk about Arizona because that's what I'm most familiar with, you'll see that Oregon's campaigns are far more expensive. And what that would do for a public financing system basically is make it prohibitively expensive, or at least in the minds of some people it would be. And so I see contribution limits only as a first step in a bigger picture. And I certainly see disclosure as essential for any kind of a system and for any kind of public accountability, frankly. And I'm hoping that the Senate will be passing and the House will be passing SB 160, which does a better job of disclosure than our current laws do. And Oregon has some of the weakest disclosure laws in the country. Now, without that diversion, I want to say that that Common Cause wants to see campaign finance reform in Oregon that can withstand court challenges that will inevitably occur. And in opening, I'll say that we are leery of amending the Oregon Constitution. And we believe that the Constitution should be amended rarely, for compelling reasons, and only after very careful consideration. Regretfully, in recent years, Oregon has been the victim of numerous ill-considered and poorly drafted constitutional amendments that have tied the hands of the legislature and, based on their content, should have been placed in statute. Therefore, we support amending the Oregon Constitution only to the extent absolutely required to enact meaningful campaign finance reform. The details of campaign finance reform should be in statute, not in the Constitution. We need an amendment because Oregon, as has been stated previously, is one of the few states that don't already have an amendment, already have limits on contributions. And the result in the state has been state legislative races that are far more expensive than those in other states approximately the same size, putting enormous pressure on candidates to continuously raise money in big chunks. As citizens watch the money chase, they wonder about the integrity of those forced to participate. They wonder if the process corrupts good people. As stated before, in 94, the Oregon voters passed overwhelmingly a contribution limits initiative, which was overturned by the courts. The only way that we could have a contributions limits measure in Oregon is with a constitutional amendment. And like the League, we support either SGR 3 or 5, but we favor 5. And I'll go into the exactly why in a few minutes. We see that those amendments avoid changing the Oregon Constitution any more than necessary to accomplish the goal of allowing campaign contribution limits and campaign finance reform consistent with the U.S. First Amendment. Now, some of the differences, one of the differences that was commented on earlier between 3 and 5 is that 5 includes the word expenses, and I want to talk about why. We feel that adding the word expenditures would allow prohibiting independent expenditures directly from corporate or union treasuries, as is allowed under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and as is done in federal law and also by most states. So basically, including expenditures there, we feel, is important for being able to do more in regulating independent expenditures, because that is, I don't know, the proper word is not loophole, but it is a way of getting around campaign finance laws. Now, under SGR 3, that proposal relies on the words made in connection with to cover the independent expenditures. And that may be sufficient because independent expenditures are indeed contributions made in connection with election campaigns. On the other hand, it might not be sufficient, and to be sure, we favor including the word expenditures. So I hope that helps you understand why we put that word in there. The intention is not expenditure limits, which are not currently allowed. Another difference between 3 and 5 is that SGR 5 includes the phrase at the end, election campaigns for nomination or election to a public office. The reason for that phrase is that contribution limits on ballot measure campaigns are not allowed under current U.S. Supreme Court rulings. And to be very clear that that is not our intention, we feel adding this phrase makes sure that the courts understand that the limits permitted are on candidate campaigns only. So in summary, we support both amendments. We feel both are good, but we feel that SGR 5 is better.
Thank you. Ms. Callis, I guess I was just commenting to committee staff as I read expenditures. I meant it in the literal term of expenditure, i.e., allowing the legislature or the voters to put limitations on how candidates spend their money. And I think that's pretty clear that that at least was not your intent. But obviously, if we decide to move forward, that's going to take some clarification.
Yes. Currently, under U.S. Supreme Court rulings, that's not allowed. So if some group put forward that kind of a limit, and if it got anywhere, it would be struck down by the courts.
Okay. Thank
Although
you.
This would perhaps, Madam Chair, be allowing voluntary spending limits for Oregon candidates if we had this phrase in there as well.
But my understanding is we have that already. I mean, yeah, folks, that's true.
Yeah.
We already have that.
So this would make it absolutely clear, Madam Chair.
So. Okay. Thank you all very much. Ms. Eaton, I just wanted to comment. My recollection of the reason why the public financing measure went down was more a condition of the circumstances of the state at the time, the financial circumstances the state was in, than whether voters rejecting the concept of public financing. Is that your assessment? Or?
Madam Chair, that's true, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all very much. We obviously have lost a number of our committee members. They have other appointments, but I would like to bring up, before we close, the neutrals and the opposition. If you all can sit at the same table together this morning, that would be great. Sarah Weatherson and Dan Meek, and then Andrea Meyer. Fire away,
okay.
Since you're here first.
Chair Brown, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. I get to quote to you, for the record, Article 1, Section 8, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject, whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. As Justice Gillette in the unanimous court wrote in the Veneta decision, the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever cannot be limited whenever it may be said that elimination of a particular form of expression might make the electorate feel more optimistic about the integrity of the political process. A contrary result would make illusory the protections afforded by Article 1, Section 8. Oregonians have a proud history of supporting the Oregon Free Expression provision set forth in that amendment. In fact, the last 10 years, Oregonians have defeated not one or two, but three constitutional provisions that would have limited Article 1, Section 8 related to sexually oriented businesses. Although each of these constitutional amendments sounded attractive, and the proponents argued the need to allow regulation of adult businesses was more important than the principle of upholding a free expression provision, Oregonians rejected the measure three times. Let there be no mistake. Both SJR 3 and 5 would amend Article 1, Section 8. 3 more explicitly, 5 omitting the language, but it would override Article 1, Section 8. It would set forth, the first time, an exception to that provision. We oppose this as a fundamental alteration of one of our most sacred documents, the Oregon Bill of Rights. The election of public officials is an essential aspect of a free society. Electing or opposing candidates and ballot measures goes to the very core of our free speech protection, namely political speech. Limitations on contributions or expenditures made by individuals or organizations for the purpose of advocating causes or candidates in the public forum impinge challenge on freedom of speech and association. It's as simple and as complicated as that. As the Oregon Supreme Court wrote, we think that it takes little imagination to see how many political contributions constitute expression. We assume, for example, that no one would deny the right of a citizen to purchase individually a newspaper ad that urges others to support a particular candidate or cause. And if that individual can persuade enough neighbors and friends to join in the effort, the resulting spending power may produce much larger ads or television or radio commercials. No one, we take it, would gainsay the right of the individual to amplify his or her voice through collective buying power. Gaining adherence for one's views is the essential purpose of political advocacy. It then follows ineluctably that the contributions of the collective pot thus collected is expression, just as the individual ad was. Indeed, it does not even matter if the money goes directly into an ad created by the contributors themselves, or instead the money goes to professionals who create the ad for a fee. The outcome is the same. Expression for the purposes of Article 1, Section 8. Viewed in the foregoing way, expenditures and contributions can be better seen for what they are, not opposite poles, but closely related activities. Now, these proposals before you would open up the door to all types of limitations. One of the expenditure changes done in McCain-Feingold was to prohibit independent expenditures for advertising within 60 days of the election. The impact of the law is felt directly by organizations like the ACLU, which has never endorsed or opposed a candidate for political office in its 82-year history and now its 50th anniversary here in Oregon. However, as the nation's oldest and largest civil liberties organization, the ACLU frequently takes public positions on important civil liberties issues. For example, the National ACLU purchased a radio advertisement in the congressional district of Dennis Hassert. Actually, I may misspeak. It may have been the local. That time, Speaker of the House of Representatives, and still, the ad called on Speaker Hassert to permit a floor vote on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, a bill to prohibit employment discrimination against gays and lesbians. The dad did not take any position on, for or against the re-election of Speaker Hastert, who was running unopposed. Yet under the new federal campaign finance laws, the ACLU can no longer broadcast that ad within 30 days of the primary or 60 days of the general election. We believe this type of restraint is directly at odds with core free speech protections. For us, the notion that the government can tell an organization like the ACLU when and how it should address important civil liberties issues is a form of censorship masquerading as campaign finance reform. Now, this is not just an ACLU concern. Concerns about the effect of this law have been expressed by the American Conservative Union, National Rifle Association, Concerned Women for America, and the Christian Coalition, to name a few. Because whether it's a communication from NARAL Pro-Choice or the Oregon Right to Life, campaign finance restrictions have broad and dangerous implications that cut to the very core of protected political advocacy. The presumption that those with the most money will defeat those with less money is not true. In fact, it was refuted this past election when now Mayor Tom Potter defeated a far more highly financed opponent. In fact, Potter ran under a voluntary campaign contribution limit and with that rose above the many candidates running for that office. You know, each legislator can and should decide whether he or she wants to take money or not. The appropriate response to any imbalance in political speech is to expand, not limit, the resources available for political advocacy. We support campaign finance reform through a system of fair and adequate public financing. It helps even the playing field, while at the same time it does not tamper with the fundamental protections provided by the founders of the Oregon Constitution. We urge this committee to reject these two constitutional amendments. If there is serious interest in pursuing campaign finance reform, we must and can do it without whittling away our long-honored protections in the Oregon Bill of Rights, Article 1, Section 8, and our free expression. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Weatherson or Mr. Meek, whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Sarah Weatherson, and I'm with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. And I'm here to speak neutrally on these two proposals. And I just want to talk about a couple of things that we look at, that MIPRAP looks at when we look at campaign finance reform proposals for the consideration of the committee. There are four basic questions that MIPRAP asks ourselves when we look at any campaign finance reform. We ask, will this change who runs for office? Will this change how campaigns are conducted? Will this change how public policy is made down the line? And will the proposed limits be legal, or will they push the envelope in a way that makes good campaign finance reform possible in the future?
other folks have talked about the differences between the two amendments, have talked about what happened in 1996 under the elections that were held under limits that we had in place in 1994. Other folks have talked about the place of independent expenditures, what happens to them during when you have an atmosphere of campaign finance limits. And I urge everybody to take a look at House Bill, I believe it's 2197, which is up for hearing this afternoon, which will strengthen, clarify some language around independent expenditures. But in any case, again, I'm here to offer information and answer questions about campaign finance reform limits, and to offer some questions, some framework to think about how to do campaign finance reform in Oregon. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Meek.
Madam Chairman and absent members, my name is Dan Meek. I reside in Portland, Oregon, 10949 Southwest 4th Avenue. I would be neutral on SJR 3, and I would support SJR 5, particularly if it were slightly amended. SJR 3, of course, as Ms. Kalos pointed out, only applies to limiting or prohibiting contributions made in connection with the financing of election campaign. So that would only partly open the window to reform in Oregon, because it would not authorize statutes either by the legislature or the people using the initiative process that would limit expenditures, including independent expenditures by folks who are not connected with the candidate, or by wealthy candidates spending their own money. This, in my view, would probably lead to the domination of campaigns in Oregon by the state-level equivalent of 527s. Therefore, I think Senate SJ Resolution 3 would probably be largely ineffective. SJR 5, on the other hand, is promising, particularly if it's slightly amended. SJR 5 would apply to allowing the enactment of laws limiting or prohibiting contributions or expenditures made in connection with election campaigns for nomination or election to public office. The legislative history should clarify that it's the intent of the legislature that this would authorize limits on independent expenditures and the spending of candidate personal wealth, both of which can completely overcome and overwhelm the ability, the expenditures that can be made by candidates who have to abide by contribution limits. And I was pleased that the Common Cause representative agreed with that interpretation. But the language is a little bit ambiguous. It does say that these expenditures, the only expenditures that can be controlled are those that are made in connection with election campaigns. It's possible that someone might interpret that to not cover or independent expenditures. And therefore, I would recommend an amendment to this, which would simply say that it covers contributions and expenditures to influence the outcome of any election, and that would clearly include independent expenditures. Limits on independent expenditures are allowable under the U.S. Constitution. As Tina Kalos pointed out, they are in place in several states and on the federal level. The U.S. Supreme Court in Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce in 1990 concluded, corporate wealth can unfairly influence elections when it is deployed in the form of independent expenditures, just as it can when it assumes the guise of political contributions. We therefore hold the state has articulated a sufficiently compelling rationale to support its restriction on independent expenditures by corporations. And according to the Brennan Center, which is a think tank on election law issues, their analysis of the McConnell decision on McCain-Feingold, which was put out, their analysis put out about a month ago, stated that in the McConnell decision, the Supreme Court reiterated Austin's holding. In addition to settling any doubt about whether current Supreme Court doctrine continues to support Austin, the McConnell Court stated in sweeping terms that Congress's power to prohibit corporations and unions from using funds in their treasuries to finance advertisements expressly advocating the election or defeat of candidates in federal elections has been firmly embedded in our law. So it's been upheld on both the federal and state level, and if there were to be a constitutional amendment in Oregon authorizing limits on contributions and expenditures, it would be far more effective if the amendment allowed such a statute to reach independent expenditures and to reach expenditures by candidates spending their own money. In Oregon, that doesn't seem to happen a lot. perhaps because there are no limits on contributions that candidates can receive from others. But where contributions are limited, such as on the federal level, we see that there is it then becomes like the U.S. Senate is now becoming a club of millionaires, of folks who are able to spend a lot of their own money. And the last time there was a really contested race for the U.S. Senate in Oregon was back when Senator Gordon Smith spent $2 million of his own money and defeated Tom Bruguer, who only spent $1 million of his own money. If you only limit contributions and don't limit candidate personal expenditures, then perhaps the Oregon State Senate will also become a Senate of millionaires. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meek. Is your major concern, your major support of campaign finance reform is to level the playing field and allow a more diverse group of folks to run for office?
There are a number of rationales. Leveling the playing field is one. In response to remarks by Senator Farioli earlier, who said this is all about corruption and we must be accusing the senators here of being corrupt, that's really not the case. What the existing system does in not limiting campaign contributions is it's not a system of corruption, it's a system of selection. And that is those who have a lot of money to spend on political campaigns, such as the corporations who typically outspend labor 5-1 in Oregon, as Sarah can point out, and typically outspend environmental and other organizations by factors of at least 3 digits, they are able to select the candidates who win. And although there are the rare exceptions, like Tom Potter, who, with his very considerable name recognition in Portland after having been police chief for many years, was able to overcome his candidate's funds, money does certainly seem to matter in the outcome of elections. If you just look at the Oregon Senate, the candidate spending the most money won 87% of the races in 2002 and 94% of the races in 2004. The only exceptions in both of those years were former legislators, so they had some name recognition, who also themselves still spent an average of $195,000 each on their races. So it's not necessarily a matter of corruption, it's a matter of selection.
And who's doing the selecting?
The contributors to the campaign are doing the selecting. They are selecting whom to support, and they are giving them the kind of overwhelming financial resources that allow them to win elections by the use of paid media.
And you don't think that the caucus campaign plays any role? We may have a couple millionaires in the state Senate. I would argue that's more a factor of our pay scale as opposed to that's how they got to the Senate. But I could be wrong.
Madam Chair, yes, as far as I know, there are a few. I don't know how many millionaires there are in the Oregon State Senate. But if contributions are limited, that is, if you prohibit corporate contributions, prohibit union contributions, and limit individual contributions, which is the federal system and has been the federal system, the prohibitions I mentioned have been the federal system for many decades, and the limits have been in place since 1974. Under that sort of a system, that encourages or tends to result in the use of personal wealth to finance campaigns. And that would result, I believe, in probably raising the average income of an Oregon state senator from other sources considerably.
Okay. Thank you. All right. I have no further questions. I appreciate you all coming and joining us this morning. I'm sure we will have continuing conversations about this issue. And with that, we are adjourned.
Yes, and it makes me feel good about the campaign.